Hebrews chapter 1. Verse 1 says, God, after He spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and many ways, spent last week talking about those, talking through the prophets, how God talked through the prophets in the Old Testament. We also talked about the many different ways that He spoke to us through the prophets in the Old Testament. There were many ways, visions and direct speaking, in a lot of ways, writing on wall, right? He did a lot. He revealed His will to man in a lot of ways in the Old Testament. And so, but God then changed the manner in which He was going to reveal what He wanted. He spoke in times past in those ways, but He changed that way that He instructed men when in verse 2 He says, the writer of Hebrews says, in these last days has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the world. So, He says in these last days. Now people get, you know, when you say last days, people's minds just begin to run everywhere, don't they? People just get all confused and all messed up in their head as far as what is being said. But when He uses this term in these last days, we must understand how Jews or Hebrews would have looked at this terminology. Not the way we see the terminology today or the way the terminology is used in the denominational, the religious world in general. But we need to consider how did the Hebrews view this kind of terminology. When a Jew read there in the first century the book of Hebrews, and he read in these last days, what pops into his mind? Because that's ultimately what the writer is going to be driving at. Well, the Jews understood last days as the messianic time. Now, they viewed time like this. They viewed time in these segments, eternity to Sinai. From Sinai to the Messiah, from the Messiah to eternity. Now, that's how the Jew looked at all of time. Now, we look at time when we think about religiously. We think about time in the dispensations, right? The patriarchal dispensation, that which went from Genesis or the beginning all the way through to the time of Moses or Mount Sinai when the law of Moses was given. Now, the patriarchal days or the patriarchal law continued on in the Gentile world, but then we see it, then we say that the next dispensation was the Mosaic dispensation. And that went from Mount Sinai all the way to the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. And at that time, we began what we say is the Christian dispensation, what the Bible refers to in the New Testament many times as the last days. Last days are not talking about, you know, we're looking for that last day. We somehow have entered a magical period of time just before the return of the Lord. That's what a lot of people think, right? When you say last days, oh, well, he must be saying the Lord's fixing to come back. We're in the last day. Yeah, we've been in the last days since AD 30. You know, we've been there a while. And so these are the last days. This is the last dispensation, the last law that will exist from God upon this earth, the Christian law. It can also be accurately translated if the writer was saying it this way, at the end of these days. And if we said at the end of these days, then what days would those be? Well, it'd be the end of the Mosaic days when God spoke through the prophets that we see in those many ways in verse 1. Prophecy and revelation came to an end with the revelation of Jesus Christ's covenant. Now, I want us to think for just a moment about progressive revelation. I'm having mic issues already. It's playing. It's running around the side of my head. God, throughout the pages of the Bible, is progressively revealing His will. You know, even when we look at the Mosaic Law, there were things about the Mosaic Law that are not allowed today, but God continued to add to the Mosaic Law over those 1,000 years. We talked about that it progressively added as it went along. That's, you know, why we see in Acts chapter 17, Paul talk about that God at one time winked at certain things or let certain things go because he didn't reveal that was wrong as of yet. Things like polygamy. You know, don't understand. People always go, well, why did God allow? Well, because His will, He had not revealed His will fully on that, what He fully wanted. He was bringing people at a pace that God understood and knew needed to come because, you know, Galatians tells us that the old law was the school teacher, right? It was the one that was slowly but surely bringing us to the point of Jesus Christ. And then that law is perfect. That law is complete. That law is total. And it is the final revelation from God of which revelation has been building up to from the very beginning of time. And so that's why now we don't have polygamy. because God has ruled that out as a part of life today in His law, in the Christian law. So we see that these things are coming about. And you know, so here we now have the culmination or the pinnacle of God's revelation. While in times past He's spoken through the prophets and in many ways, now He's speaking through the final, the ultimate, and that's Jesus Christ. And that's really what the book of Hebrews is going to be driving at, that Jesus Christ is superior, that He is greater than everything else. There will never be anything else greater than Jesus Christ. He is the final aspect of revelation by God. So He says He has spoken to us in His Son. John chapter 1 and verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You know, it's not a mistake. While John's the only one that does it, he does it for a very specific purpose when he calls Jesus the Word, the Logos, literally the embodiment of truth, literally the life that showed truth. He is. Everything about truth is realized and seen in Jesus Christ. John 1 goes on to say that truth and grace were realized in Jesus Christ. They were made clear. They were made known. They were made manifest in Jesus Christ. And so when He speaks in His Son, we are seeing the end of it all. We're seeing the fullness of God's truth revealed. He is the Word, the source of the Word of God, because He is that Word of God. God is truth. It is His nature. And that is how Jesus Christ is the Word. Now, the gospel is Jesus Christ, isn't it? What is the gospel without Jesus Christ? What good are we? What good would it be to be here this morning if there was no Jesus Christ? No good. It accomplishes nothing. Your prayer would be worthless if Jesus Christ was not a reality. If Jesus Christ is not everything the book of Hebrews says He is, and the rest of the Bible says that He is. You know, the gospel is Jesus Christ. The gospel is His life, isn't it? We live following the pattern that He set down for us, Peter said. We follow His life pattern. We become like Him. We wear His name, Christian, to be Christ-like. We literally wear His name. He is the gospel. The gospel is His death, isn't it? For without the sacrifice for sin that Jesus Christ was, no sin can or could ever be forgiven. For the blood of bulls and goats took away how many sins in the Old Testament? Not a one. They killed a lot of them, didn't they? I mean, a lot of them. There were in AD 68, just before the Romans laid siege to the city of Jerusalem at the Passover, they sacrificed over 200,000 lambs. 200,000. And they didn't do one thing to take away a sin other than just obeying God. Because that blood could not take away sin. So the gospel is Jesus' death. It's also His resurrection, isn't it? According to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, what good is it to live the Christian life if Jesus Christ didn't rise from the dead? You're foolish. You're a fool. If there is no resurrection, if when you die you're like old Rover and you're dead all over, there is no reason to live the Christian life. That's a waste. Paul said that. He says you might as well just eat, drink, and just have a good old time, because tomorrow you're dead and it just doesn't matter. But see, it does matter. Because Jesus Christ did rise from the dead, right? He is the gospel. He is the embodiment of it. He is the center of it. He is all of it. And that is why He is called by John the Word. He gave us that law. While Moses gave the law of Moses, or the law for the Jews, or to the Israelites on there on Mount Sinai, Jesus Christ, God Himself, gave the law for Christians. He's far superior to Moses and any other prophet. Here where it says that He has spoken to us in His Son, spoken there is, when you talk about Greek tenses, first aorist, active, literally means one time, good for all time. Okay? I love it when people say to me, and I've had some of certain religious groups walk up to me and say, well, you know, Mr. Adams, the Bible's been corrupted. You know, it's been all messed up over the years, the translation and a lot of other things. And God, because of that, because God can't hold a book together, then he had to give a new revelation, right? Hebrews says that he gave it once and one time only. Jude would tell us that the law was, the perfect law was delivered once, right? It was delivered once to the saints. Not twice, not going to happen again, but once. And Jesus spoke and his law was revealed once to mankind. Peter tells us in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3 that it has all things that pertain to life and godliness. Please tell me what's left. If God's Word tells us all things for life and godliness, what else do I need? Nothing. That covers it. How to live life and how to live life godly. Those are the two most important things that we need to know, and God's Word covers it. Takes care of it. And so we don't need another revelation. We don't need some kind of latter-day revelation. We don't need God speaking to us and telling us something new. You know, a preacher in the Lord's church a few years back, two or three years back when I was, well, it's been longer than that, hasn't it, since I've been in Texas? Several years back, when I was down in Texas, he got up and he said, 11 years ago, and he was preaching just down the road from where I was at, 11 years ago I was up preaching and God spoke to me while I was preaching and told me that instrumental music was okay. Took him 11 years to finally come around and tell everybody. You know, if I really did think God spoke to me and told me something, I wouldn't wait 11 years to come and tell you. Right? But God had told him something that wasn't there in the Bible. Given him a message. The message has been given. And it was given once. God's not given anymore. Just like when we read in Exodus, and it says that God created everything on the earth and in the heavens in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. And likewise, you are to work 6 days, and on the seventh day you're to rest. Everything on the earth and in the heavens was created in 6 days. God's not creating anymore. He's done creating. And according to Hebrews 1 here, that he spoke to us in his Son once and once for all, he's done revealing. He has revealed it, and we have that which 1 Corinthians 13 calls that which is what? Perfect. Now, do we need to improve on perfect? Yeah, I mean, seriously, do we need to improve on that? No. He said that when that which is perfect comes, that which is in part, those gifts of the Spirit will be done away with, and one of those gifts includes inspiration. God speaking through men miraculously. So we see that this is once given. Jesus is the lawgiver now, not Moses or the father of a family as it was during the patriarchal time. The Hebrews held the words of men like Moses and Abraham to be of great importance, but when you consider who Jesus Christ is, and we're about to see the writer of Hebrews go into that, when we consider who Jesus Christ is, how much more important are his words? Now remember what we said about the people that are being written to. They are thinking about, they are discouraged and they're thinking about leaving Christianity and returning to Judaism, right? And the writer of Hebrews is making an effort here to show how Jesus Christ is better. So he begins right out of the gate. He's making a comparison here between Jesus and the prophets. We're going to see him give 7 ways here. In fact, this first chapter is broke up into 2 sets of 7. 7 ways that Jesus Christ is superior to the prophets, who they held in such high regard. And then we're going to spend the rest of the chapter, 7 ways in which Jesus Christ is superior to the angels. And so, you know, he's constantly showing Jesus to be superior. So he goes on, he says, whom he appointed heir of all things. Matthew chapter 28, verse 18. Jesus Christ, just before his ascension, speaking to the apostles there, said, all authority, all power and authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth, right? Now, what authority is left out in all authority? See, the Bible doesn't leave anything out there. You know, it doesn't have some authority so that we're wondering, well, what authority does he not have? No, he has it all. He's God. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And then he goes into the Great Commission. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 18. the Apostle Paul there writes, He is also the head of the body, the church, and He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that He Himself will come to have first place in everything. You get what that's saying there? Now, Jesus is first place no matter what. Okay, we need to designate that, okay? Whether you let Him be first place in your life, yes, you can choose, but there's going to come a day when your knee will bow and your tongue will confess, right? And He will be first. Now, it's whether you'll let Him be first at a time that it'll do something for you or benefits you spiritually. But He will be first because He is. And you and I have nothing to say about that. But now, will we let that be the case in our lives? While we have choice, while it makes a difference eternally. But He will be first. Another word that we could use there for He is to be first place in all things is that He is preeminent. Could be a way you could translate that He is preeminent in all things. You know, the writer begins to give evidence that Jesus is preeminent or He is superior in all things to the prophets through certain characteristics of His nature. He is heir to all things. He is the rightful recipient as the faithful Son of God, right? He deserves everything that He has received. He has done the things that are necessary to receive those things that He has all power and authority. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 22 through 23. And He put all things in subjection under His feet and gave Him as head over all things to the church, which is His body, the fullness of Him who fills all in all. We are His body. We are in subjection. All things are under His subjection. This makes Jesus greater than all the prophets, greater than Moses or Abraham, because they never had such authority, did they? Moses never said, "You Jew, you Israelites, you're my body," right? "And I feel you all." No, they kind of made Him that way, didn't they? They kind of raised Moses up above what Moses would have ever raised himself up to be. They kind of did the same thing with Abraham, didn't they? But Abraham never would have said that. Moses would never said that. In fact, the book of Hebrews says that Moses and Abraham were looking for, in Hebrews 11, they were looking for the promise of Christ. They knew that they were not what was the end of it all. They knew that they were simply a part of the journey to that which all were looking toward. That was Jesus Christ. Hebrews 11 makes that very clear to us, and we'll talk about that when and if we ever get there. But he also says, well, why would, and here's the question, I guess, for the Hebrews, and it's really a question for us as well if we ever contemplate leaving the Lord's church. Why would a person leave Christ for something less? Now, if you live in a 3,000 square foot house, would you like to leave your house and move into an 1,800 or 1,000 square feet? Let's just cut her away. Let's cut her down. Number one, what are you going to do with all your junk, right? Let's just call it what it is. It's junk. We buy new houses when we get more junk than our house can hold, right? Because we keep buying them when we've stopped having children. So it has nothing to do with the number of people. It has to do with the amount of junk. But how easy would that, how much would you want to do that? Drop down like that. How much would you want to do? Let's say you're making $150,000 a year at your job. How about you drop down to 40? Anybody want to do that one? Why leave something better to go to something less? We don't like that. That doesn't make sense. Why leave Jesus Christ, who is preeminent in all things, first in all things, to go to anything else? In this particular case for the Hebrews, to go back to the law of Moses certainly wasn't as good. Wasn't even in effect anymore, so it had no power to help anybody. But also, to leave the Lord's church to go back into sin, go to some other religious group. You know, Jesus is best. Why would we want to leave the best for any of the rest? Well, it says not only is He heir of all things, but it says through whom also He made the world. Well, this is why Jesus has the authority He has, right? People go, well, why follow Jesus? Right there. I'm His creation. He made me. He made you. He made everything. You look up into the night sky as far as you can see and all the stars that you can see, Jesus Christ made them. As Creator, does He have rights over His creation? If you invent something and you build it with your own hands out in your garage, Forrest's very good in his garage. I've seen things he makes. But if you invent something and you make something and you build it in your garage, do you have rights over that which you made? It's yours, isn't it? Other people can't copy it. Other people can't have it. It's yours. And you can use it and do with it what you please. We are God's creation. We are the creation of Jesus Christ. That is where the authority that the book of Hebrews is talking about comes from. It comes from the fact, from the reality that Jesus Christ is Creator of all things. Colossians 1. You know, and this isn't a point that's just made here in Hebrews. Colossians 1 says that He's the Creator. John 1 says that He's Creator, that God made all things through Him. And so, you know, when we literally hear, "Let there be light" in Genesis chapter 1, we're hearing the Word speak. Jesus Christ speaking the world into existence. Speaking light into existence in that particular case. The Word speaking there too. And so, you know, Jesus Christ was not, as some have proposed even in the Christian world, Jesus Christ was not created. The created cannot create itself, can it? Now, well, I guess the Big Bang Theory says it can. But in reality, that's not possible. He is Creator. He's not created. He is to be worshipped because He's not the creature, according to Romans 1, right? But the Creator. Remember what happened with the people? That they gave up God and chose to worship the creature, created, rather than the Creator. So Jesus Christ is worthy of our worship. John 1 says that in the beginning, and that literally means there, when we talk about in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, in the beginning there literally means before beginning. He was there when they decided that there would be a beginning, right? Time is a creation. Eternity does not exist in time. God created time in the beginning. He started the clock, didn't He? You know, He wound it up and set it off. But God was already there before time ever existed. So was Jesus Christ. He existed before that moment. That's why in John chapter 8 and verse 58. Why did Jesus almost get stoned in that text? Anybody tell me? They tried to stone Him. They would have. Had He not been Jesus Christ and able to get away. Before Abraham was, I am, yeah. The eternal present. Literally the same phraseology as when Moses asked, "Who do I tell them you are?" "Tell them I am that I am." Right? Jesus says, "Before Abraham was." They said, How do you know Abraham? You're not even 30 years, you know, you're a young man, whatever. And He goes, "Before Abraham was born, I am." And they tried to stone Him because they knew exactly what He was saying. He was equating Himself to the eternal present of God, living outside of the time that we live in on this earth. Verse 3, He continues to describe Jesus. He says, "And He is the radiance of His glory and the exact representation of His nature, and upholds all things by the word of His power. When He made purification of sins, He sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high." Now, in the Old Testament, God showed His presence in various ways. What are the ways that God showed Himself? No man has seen God. John makes that clear, right? Whirlwind. Yeah, the tornado there for Job when He came and spoke to Job. You know, Job said, "Hey, God, I just want you to come down and talk to me. Come on, just come talk to me, God." And then God came to talk to him. Job didn't want to talk. He said, "I put my hand over my mouth. This is a little more than I thought." You know, it's times when I thought I had the perfect thing to say to my mama until she responded. then I decided it wasn't so great? What other ways did God present himself in the Old Testament? Burning bush? The cloud? Well, he manifests himself in two ways. Cloud in the day. Pillar of fire at night. Yes. Paul was also saying that. I guess we could say the lightning and the thunder and the things that were going on there on that mountain as well. A few weeks ago we talked about Abraham, right? Abraham in Genesis chapter 15, when Abraham received that covenant with God. Remember, they cut the animals in half and they walked between them, and that basically said that if I don't keep this covenant, then I will forfeit my life, as these animals were forfeited theirs. God literally, I guess we could say, put his life into the covenant. But how did he appear to Abraham when he went between those animals? Don't y'all listen to my sermons at all. Man, tell you what. He was a burning furnace going between those things in the light of the day. How did he appear to Abraham before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed? As a man in white. Yeah, with two angels. And, you know, like I told you a few weeks ago, we discovered, according to the History Channel Bible series, that those angels were samurai. They had the swords and they could go off. I'm so glad when I have those things to look at and learn from. How did he present himself to Elijah that scared Elijah to death? Remember, he presented himself as a wind that destroyed everything and a fire that consumed everything. But those didn't seem to bother Elijah all that much. What was it that he did that scared him? Still small voice. See, God, unlike some parents, and you know, I know if you're a parent, you understand that sometimes a calm voice just doesn't seem to get your children's attention, does it? You know, please don't do that. It's like they're completely tuned out. I mean, it has to reach a certain decibel level sometimes before it gets through their eardrum and into their brain, right? God, just in a still, small voice, will scare you to death. He's that powerful. That's how he reveals himself. That's how he revealed himself in the Old Testament. A little different in the New. In the New, God revealed himself or showed himself to us in Jesus Christ. You know, Jesus not only showed God's presence, and Jesus was God's presence. Remember Isaiah chapter 7, what the child was to be named? That would be born of, in Isaiah, it's a maiden, but when it's used in the Greek, it's a virgin. Can't be anything else. But what was that child to be named? Emmanuel. What does that name mean? God is with us. Now, Jesus was never named Emmanuel. He was named Jesus by decree, but he was God with us, wasn't he? He did live up to the name, Emmanuel. He was God with us. So not only did God show his presence in Jesus Christ, he showed us God's nature by the way that he lived and helped us understand God in a way that was not possible before his life. You know, when we think about God, we just finished a rather lengthy discussion about God and his nature. It's all seen in perfection in Jesus Christ. That's where we really are able to see the love and the power of God. The life that he lived and what he did in those, you know, we only have 3 weeks of Jesus' life recorded. Did he make a difference in those 3 weeks? I mean, I wished I could make that kind of difference in 3 weeks of my life, right? I don't think I've made that big of a difference in 42 years, and probably won't if I live to be 100. And my wife says, if I don't start exercising, that ain't going to be a problem. But, you know, it is something that Jesus was amazing. But he says that in this showing us God, he was the radiance of his glory. That's what Jesus was. He was the radiance of his glory. The direct shining of his glory is another way that it can be translated. And I think that's probably a way that we're going to better be able to understand it. The direct shining of his glory. The light that shines through us as Christians is indirect, isn't it? I'm reflecting Jesus. Jesus is shining through me, but the light is not me. It's Him. in me, right? So I'm not directly, I'm indirect. But Jesus Christ was direct. He was the light. He was the light of men. When you look at John 1 or John chapter 3, either one. That the light came from Him as God. So He shines. He is the radiance or the shining of God. When Jesus came, it was that direct radiance of God coming from God Himself and not just shining through someone else. In John chapter 1, beginning with verses 4 through 5, it says, "In Him was life, and the life was the light of men." Now, that's what I mentioned a while ago in John chapter 3. He goes on, you know, we read right up to John 3:16, right? We just kind of quit. We just think, well, there's the pinnacle of this chapter, and I'm done. Man, let me tell you what, there's a lot after verse 16, isn't there? Stuff just as powerful as verse 16. We love verse 16. I love verse 16. I can't imagine anybody here doesn't love verse 16 of John chapter 3, but there's more to the chapter than verse 16. Verse 19, he says, "This is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than the light." And the light there is not just truth. This is Jesus Christ. "And men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light and does not come to the light, for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, so that his deeds may be manifested or shown as having been wrought by God." So if you're wanting to examine something, let's say you're going to work on your watch. Do you do that in darkness? How about just room light? Is that good enough usually? No, you need a, if you're really good, if you're really kind of industrious, you have one of those little magnifying glass with the light, right? But if you're like me, you just have the little LED light that you're shining on. But you shine a light on it, right? It shows you the inner workings. And that's what he's talking about here. Jesus Christ shows who we are. The light that he shines. That is the reason they killed him, right? Did he, in shining as the light of God, did he show who the Pharisees were? Sadducees? Jewish leaders? Scribes? Lawyers? Yeah, that's why they killed him. Because he made it so apparent when you stood next to Jesus, when Jesus was there and the Pharisees were there, it was very clear who the right people were, right? That's why at times it says they didn't talk to him anymore. Because he was making them look bad. And they did look bad because they were bad. You know, he wasn't just making them look bad. They were bad. He was just showing it. You know, certainly in Matthew 23, when he gives the woes to the Pharisees, he's certainly shining some light on them, isn't he? But I think it's things people already knew. He wasn't having to really convince them, was he? So Jesus had that ability. You know, Jesus shined the radiance of His holiness as God, and it came from who He was, and it was not reflected or indirect. It was different than any other man on this earth. You know, over and over I can make the point that when we read that no man has seen God except as He has been revealed by the only begotten, that term "only begotten" there is Greek word monogenēs, which means unique. And we could just go back to that and back to that in the book of Hebrews, because we're seeing the unique Jesus Christ. He was a man, but He's a man like no one else. You can't compare me to Him. It's apples and oranges, isn't it? He's unique. And that's literally what only begotten means, the unique Son of God. I'm a son of God, but I'm not a son of God like Jesus Christ. We need to be careful that we don't just, you know, sometimes we talk about Jesus, our brother, and that's true in a sense, but we need to understand that we are in no way on any level with Jesus Christ as He is a son of God compared to what we are as sons of God. He is the unique Son of God. While Ishmael was the brother of Isaac, Isaac was called the only begotten son of Abraham. Okay? So Jesus Christ is the unique. He is one of a kind. And the rest of us try to ascribe to Him. Yes, sir?
Mentioned about the light. That's why the Word tells us that the world is going to hate us because we're shining the light boldly on the world and show the evil that's in it, and they'll hate us for it.
Yeah. You know, that last night, I mean, just before the culmination of all the hatred against Jesus came in the cross the next morning, Jesus said, "They hated me, they're going to hate you." Why are they going to hate you? Because you are showing me. You know, ultimately, if the world could hate, will hate Jesus. If you put on Jesus in your life, if you show Jesus in your life, if you shine the light of Jesus in your life, they're going to hate you too. because there's going to be the same product because we are emulating Him in our lives every day. And so we need to be aware of that. We need to not be deceived into believing that somehow, you know, everybody's just going to be nice to us, right, if we're the good people we ought to be. You know, some people don't like nice people, do they? Some people don't like good people. Some people think you make them look bad, you know. Just like John said about Cain and Abel, right? Why did Cain kill his brother? Because his brother's deeds were righteous and his were not. And it's the same still today. Man does not change. Nothing new under the sun. Yes. Well, we judge people by their fruits. No, they really were. I mean, when you look at those men, they were not functioning from rightness. They were functioning from selfishness and seeking power. Well, I think that's the case with some people. She's talking about that some people can fool themselves into thinking they're right, and I think that's the case with some. I don't think that's the case with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but I do think that's the case with a lot of people. I've known a lot of people that really, honestly, deep in their heart, believe they were right, and that's one thing. You know, that's one thing. And Sadducees and Pharisees are kind of over here and literally seeking not right at all, but just seeking power and things like that, and that's a completely different kind of a person too. But yeah, I think some people do. They do see themselves. I think you see the people that Jesus dealt with, a lot of the Jews really felt like they were right in regards to what the Messiah was going to be. They really thought He was supposed to be a king. And they believed that with all their heart. They believed it honestly. But they were wrong. And only those that would accept that fact, and usually, you know, a lot of times when we see it was shown, like with Paul preaching in the synagogues or even Peter on the day of Pentecost, when you laid out the argument with all the Old Testament scriptures and the prophecies to go along with it, you saw that Jesus Christ really was what the Messiah was intended to be. You know, Paul, the entire sermon of the day of Pentecost, we kind of, another time where we just focus one verse, right? We're 38. We love 38. But, you know, the rest of that entire sermon is proving one thing and one thing only, that Jesus Christ was the prophesied Messiah. That's the whole sermon. You know, and once they came to realize that, that's when they went, oh my, we killed the Messiah, right? What must we do? Man, we've been waiting all our lives for this, and what did we do when He got here? We killed Him. Great. You know, now what do we do? All of our hopes are dashed, but they weren't dashed, were they? And that's what Peter's telling them now, that they're, you know, He came so that I can tell you this. And so, you know, there was people that believed wrong and people today that believe wrong, honestly, and we need to understand. There's a difference. Let me make one more distinction on that before the bell rings. I think a distinction can be made when we think about it like this. There are people in the Lord's church that may not understand certain things, okay? You know, just either they're young or they haven't studied as well as they should, but they don't understand certain things, and they may say certain things that are not accurate with the Bible. Now, there are people that do that not intending to teach wrong, but they're just mistaken. They haven't studied enough to, and they're speaking about something they're not informed on. That's one thing. Very different from the guy who has determined that he's going to teach something the Bible doesn't teach, and he's going to preach it like a false teacher, right? And I'm going to teach it, and I'm doing it deliberately, and I'm not going to stop. That's a very different person, isn't it? Now, they both have the same problem. They're saying something that maybe doesn't match up with the Bible, but you got two different attitudes in play. One that, you know, this person over here, they're making a mistake. We need to work with them. We need to help them see the truth. Now, this person over here that's going to teach it, and that's what they want, and that's what they're going to do, you know, you have to deal with them differently. You have to be a little more direct with them. You have to, you know, convict the gainsayer, as Titus tells us. You have to, you know, you have to, if necessary, remove that leaven from the lump. But everybody here is in a growth process. We're learning things, and there's times when we may think things that are not, you know, that we eventually realize, hey, as I've continued to study, I've realized that that wasn't accurate. But, you know, it's very different than the person who's actively trying to take people away. There are wolves in sheep's clothing, as Jesus put them, right? Not everybody that makes a mistake is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Some are just sheep that have gotten away from the fold, right? But then there are wolves in sheep's clothing. There are, as Paul said to the Ephesian elders in Acts chapter 20, there are those that are ravenous wolves seeking to devour the flock. Okay? Two different groups. Both doing the same thing, but with two different attitudes. And so I think what Kathy was talking about was that there are some, I think Pharisees would fall into the wolves or sheep's clothing. I think that's exactly what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 7. But then there are those Jews that were mistaken, but were honestly mistaken and not trying to do damage. And so we have to deal with those on their unique merits. So he is the exact representation of his nature. Now John chapter 1 and verse 18 says, "No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him." And so that's basically saying the same thing that the writer of Hebrews is saying, that Jesus Christ has explained him or has become the exact representation of God. You want to see God? Look at Jesus, right? Isn't that what happened in John chapter 14, verses 8 through 9? What did Philip say? "Lord, show us the Father and it'll be enough," right? That's all we need. Hey, can't you just see Jesus? I mean, I guess if it was me, maybe I shouldn't apply what I might do to Jesus because he'd do better. But can't you just see him go, you know, maybe click his tongue a couple of times like my mama would do? You know, Philip, don't you know, if you've seen me, you've what? Seen the Father. Does that sound like exact representation? He didn't say, if you've seen me, you've seen some of the Father. He didn't say, if you've seen me, you've seen most of the Father. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so, you know, we see him as the exact representation. In fact, we'll look more at that text next week with Philip, because I think there's some interesting things that are said after that particular statement. But appreciate your good attention, good comments this morning.